Succession number 21095, reel 15.
Helipic, reel 15.
On, I think, the second day of the summer march, at the end of the day, I invited a journalist from the Washington Post to drive back with me to Selma. He happened to be black and a man, and he sat next to me in the car. And when we got back to Selma in the hotel, I took him with me into the bar. And immediately the barman came up, whispering up to me, and said, if I were you, I would not bring this person into this bar. So, you know, we both of us left. Then the next day, a woman who was shot driving a car with a black man at her side. And I thought, well, I've had a lucky escape. But then on the last day of the march, when we had arrived in Governor Wallace's capital, there was a very, very moving evening where a lot of the marchers had gathered outside in a field, and Martin Luther King, of course, was there, and Ralph Bunche, who was a senior official at the UN as well as an American black, and everybody, black and white, we all sat on the ground, and everybody was singing "We Shall Overcome" over and over again. And somehow I've always sort of kept the sound of that particular version of "We Shall Overcome" in my mind, because I suppose at the time, I don't know how many of us realized just how significant the Selma March had been in terms of the civil rights movement. But we all knew that we had participated, even at the margins, in something quite extraordinary and exceptional.
How big were those marches?
Oh, well, when we started at Selma, I don't know, hundreds, many hundreds. I don't know, at the end, it probably wasn't quite as big anymore as it was at the beginning, but it was certainly massive. And I mean, who would have imagined then again that Governor Wallace in the end would change to the extent that he in the end he actually did accommodate himself to the black presence, but at the time he certainly didn't. But and then I went, you know, I was in Mississippi and I went to Birmingham, and you know, I reported on many riots and all those civil rights demonstrations of that period. I was at them, but I think it's only afterwards, when you try to sort of reconstruct what actually happened, that you realize what an amazing change all that had brought about. And at the time, you were just writing about the day's events, and you don't have the perspective that you have afterwards. But certainly I wouldn't have missed all that for the world. And it was a long way from the UN. You really felt you were in the real world, not in the sort of make-believe world of the UN, where you were somehow sitting in a great big capsule and a Tower of Babel, but not a place where there's real action. And then you go out into the field and you see how real people have to cope, as I saw afterwards going to Eastern Europe, but that came much later. But you know, at that time, my understanding and experience of Eastern Europe was the UN plus Yugoslavia, so that didn't amount to very much. and certainly distorted.
Were you part of the march? Did you go along with the march?
Yes, we walked by the side of it.
Yes. How many white people would there have been participating?
Oh, just a small fraction. Well, certainly some, but not a fraction of the blacks who were there. But there certainly were some, but you know, it was fraught with a degree of danger. You know, the journalist is always a sort of more or less immune to it. But yes, of course. I mean, like the woman who was shot. I can't remember. That was on the last day, and she was driving one of the demonstrators somewhere. And you know, you were not supposed to have one. I mean, they could be sitting in the back, but they certainly couldn't be sitting with you in the front of the car. But, I mean, if they were your driver, that's a different matter again. But then you were sat in the back. But, no, it's these are all just some fragments of my memory, and I would really have to start looking again at the cuttings from that period, and then I suppose this would all come much more alive, and I should have done that before we had our talk today, because...
Can you remember your impression of Dr. King?
I think it's very hard to disentangle my impression of Dr. King from the impression that I have from endlessly watching replays of his speeches. At the time, he was obviously an inspirational figure and the key figure, and you sensed here was a leader. But I find it very hard to tell you now which Martin Luther King I really know, the one that I observed during those few days, or the one that's been on my television screens and on my radio for all these years and over and over again. And don't forget, the Americans have made some really superb films about the civil rights movement, and I've watched most of those. And again, I think one's memory of one's own experiences gets confused and mixed up with watching those films, recalling certain things. And every time I see another shot of Selma, I can see myself exactly where I was and, you know, where we were walking and this kind of, and I can still see the hood. Selma is a very handsome town. It has a sort of Venetian type of architecture. It's really very pretty town, and I remember that. I can visualize the hotel bar I just mentioned to you, but at the same time, when it comes to the sort of really big changes that were underway and all the bits that I didn't see and didn't witness, by now, you know, it all sort of melds into one big long saga, and I find it quite hard to say what my impressions were, my personal impressions, and what my impressions were from seeing those films. But for instance, I remember very vividly being in Birmingham when the riots started, and watching the fire engines coming in both with tear gas and with water cannons, trying to disperse people, and you know, us the journalists sort of running off in all directions. The fire engines were coming from all directions with water cannon and with tear gas, and people were scurrying all over the place, and including obviously the journalists. And as I'm one of nature's cowards, I think I really tried to get away rather than try and witness what was going on. But I think I probably saw enough to write my stories. Of course, that was the time also when the church was set on fire. But I do recall also meeting some very prominent white representative of the community who were very, very much on the side of the blacks, of the demonstrations, and very much opposed to the way in which the government was countering the riots. So I think those made for very good stories. That's a trite way of putting it. But it was, I found interesting to see that there were prominent members of the white community who were on the side of the civil rights fighters, and were not part of the old southern establishment opposed to anything that might extend the civil rights of the black communities. But again, things have changed and have not changed. it's possible that with the sort of early successes of the civil rights movement then, a lot of people assumed that things, integration might go faster than it has done, but though in some respects the South is now more integrated than the North of the United States, I think the lessons of Florida have shown that integration goes up to a certain point, and when it comes to voting machines, for example, the antiquated ones are in the black communities and the more advanced, sophisticated ones are in the prosperous white communities. But these are all refinements of a process which certainly got a big boost during that period. Partly thanks, of course, to LBJ, to President Johnson. I often wonder what might have happened if President Kennedy had remained alive, whether he would have been able to do as much for the blacks, especially in terms of legislation, as President Johnson got through a Congress that he could manage in ways that Kennedy never could.
Why was that, do you think?
Well, LBJ was a product of the Congress. You know, he knew everybody. Also, his personality was very different. And I think his commitment to domestic change was far greater. With Kennedy, I don't know. I wonder if Kennedy had lived, what kind of a president he would have been in the end. You know, we shall never know. I mean, he is the great hero figure to us now. And he was dynamic, and he was charismatic, and his appeal to Americans, to America, to provide real leadership in the world was impressive. But on the domestic front, I think you really have to question how far he would have wanted to go, how far he would have been prepared to fight for what he wanted. And I think LBJ was a fighter, and he was committed to civil rights. And if he hadn't got caught up in Vietnam, you know, he might have been around much longer as president, and he might have achieved far more for American society than he did. But I think he has to go down as one of the more significant American presidents.
Did you meet him?
Yes, but I mean, you know, casually, not...
You didn't do an interview with...
Not to interview, no. No, I know, because, you know, American presidents rarely make themselves available to European correspondents. Now there is a sort of custom which I think started with Carter, and certainly was taken up by Bush and Reagan as well, that they would give interviews to the representative of a newspaper from one of the countries that they would, just before they made an official visit to countries, they would have one or two of the foreign correspondents in. In my case, my predecessor in Washington, I mentioned that we had this correspondent, Max Friedman, who had originally been Alistair Cook's friend, and then they became such bitter enemies. Max became very friendly with the Kennedys, and often acted as Jackie's escort when to go to theaters and parties and all sorts of things when the president was unavailable or didn't want to go or whatever. And he made much of his connections with the White House. And there were one or two other correspondents, British correspondents in Washington, who had in fact made very close contact with the White House and had been able to maintain it. But the closest I got to the Kennedys was that I became great friends with Pierre Salinger, the President Kennedy's spokesman, and he did take me along once to Cape Cod, to Hyannis Port, and there I met both President Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, but again, you know, as part of a larger group, it was just a party, it wasn't an interview. But Pierre Salinger, who's remained a sort of lifelong friend, I mean, he certainly, I mean, it was extremely helpful to me as a source, but also introduced me to all the people around President Kennedy. But, you know, the presidents, except for the sort of personal friendships which they forged through either before they were president or so on with European journalists, on the whole, don't have much contact with them, and therefore, you know, don't get to know them. You don't get to know them so at close quarters. But, you know, I went to endless press conferences, and, you know, in those days, in those ways, one gets very close to them. And I went on the presidential campaigns, and, you know, you see the candidates non-stop. But again, not sort of for one-on-one conversations. I can't claim that privilege.
Who would have been the Secretary General of the UN during your time?
Well, I came in with U Thant, the Burmese Secretary General, and he was a very nice man whom I got to know quite well. Quiet, thoughtful, obviously much involved with Asian affairs and China and so on. But in retrospect, he didn't establish, you know, few people remember that he was Secretary General. He didn't make a lasting impression on the history of the UN. And then, of course, Waldheim, whom I'd known already as ambassador, and then as Secretary General, and, you know, whom I got to know personally quite well, never thought much of, still think the best description of him was written once in the New Yorker when they said that if Kurt Waldheim stood on the other side of the bar in the UN delegates' lounge, everybody would say he was a terrific head waiter. And I think that really summed him up. He was always servile. And his wife was always very keen on being the Secretary General's wife and the standing that she thought he gave her in New York society. And then Paris de Quella, I didn't know, I hardly knew him. But then I became great friends with Boutros Ghali. I was one of the very few journalists that Boutros Ghali liked. I interviewed him, I think, just after he'd become Secretary General. And whatever the reason was, he liked me. And after that, whenever I was in New York, I mean, I always had his private telephone number, and I, you know, quite often I'd phone him from London, and he would even phone me. And he always had me for meals in his house. And I remember once I was amused. I'd been there for lunch and with his wife and one or two other people. And after lunch, he said to me, "Hella, come upstairs with me." And I was surprised. He said, "I want to show you something." And he took me to his bedroom to show me some drawings by Matisse of one of his models, and Uthan said, "You know, she used to be my girlfriend, and quite recently she sent me these. She was one of Matisse's models, And quite recently she'd sent him these drawings and he'd put them up and he wanted me to see them. So I know what his bedroom looked like, and I certainly liked the drawings in his bedroom.
Yes, talk about come up and see my etchings.
But Madame Bouteau's garden was waiting for me downstairs.
Did he make a difference, do you think, Boutros Ghali?
Well, I think he was a better Secretary General than a lot of people give him credit for. I think I think his agenda for peace, which he wrote in sort of about a year after he'd become Secretary General, was a blueprint for the way the UN could move on, both with preventive diplomacy and with peacekeeping operations. And of course he, like his successor, argued very strongly that the UN, not NATO, should or the European Union, should have a rapid reaction force so that member countries trained military personnel for peacekeeping duties and could make those forces available at very short notice. And he recognized that you had to reorganize the whole command structure at the UN and the military command structure and so on. But at the time was highly praised, but afterwards totally ignored. And the only thing that people like to remember about him is that he was rather autocratic in his dealings with his staff, which undoubtedly was true. And that he didn't, he obviously had a great dispute with the Americans, and particularly with Madeleine Albright, who was the American ambassador at the United Nations for most of his tenure, who made up her mind that under no circumstances could he be allowed to have a second term. Also, to be fair, he had become Secretary General on the understanding that he would only be there for one term, and then as his first term drew towards a close, he announced that he was a candidate for a second term. And so he'd really gone back on his promise, and a lot of people didn't forgive him for that. I'm not an objective judge, partly because I had this very good relationship with him, and partly because he sometimes took my advice, because he had appalling sort of public relations in the UN. And together with the correspondent of the New York Times, who's a friend of mine, we wrote him a memo on what we thought he ought to do to improve his information and PR staff and policy. And I remember we did it very short on just two pieces of paper, and rather than take it up to his office on the 38th floor, I actually took it to his house and handed it over to his security guard to give to him, so that we'd be quite sure that he would get it and not one of his factotums, who would then not pass it on. And whether or not this led him to the decision that he took, but at any rate, he did one thing that I had suggested to him, which was to get a young woman called Silvana Foer, who had been the spokesperson of the High Commission for Refugees in Geneva, to become the Secretary General's spokesperson. And he brought her to New York, and she was excellent, but she clashed with his chief and chef de cabinet and various other people, and she was just kept out of the loop, and he didn't spend enough time briefing her. And so in the end, she was sort of ad-libbing policy without really knowing what was going on the 38th floor. And it's created a lot of unhappiness all around, so that rather misfired, but at least the intention had been there to get a good spokesperson in. But Kofi Annan again is somebody that I've known, since I think we first met when I first came to America, and he was studying in America, and we had mutual friends, and so I know him quite well. So here's the list of UN Secretary Generals that I've known. A rather better parade than American presidents that I've known. But I can't trump it with East African leaders I've known.
You're doing very well, I think. So how long were you in America, working in America?
Well, the first time round, I was there until, I think, around 67. I had, during that period between 62 and 67, I'd had quite an extended period in Washington because Max Friedman very suddenly left the Guardian almost from one day to the next. Sorry, that's a little anecdote that I'll put into it. He announced that he was getting married and was no longer prepared to go on working for the Guardian. And the paper decided that Richard Scott, who had been diplomatic correspondent, the man who brought me to the paper, would be his successor. But Richard was in the middle of a divorce and couldn't come for about 6 or 9 months. And so I was asked to go and fill in Washington. And at that time, the Guardian still had an office in the Washington Post. And I, you know, found the Washington Post and the Guardian room and came into a completely empty room. It had a typewriter in it and empty shelves, empty in baskets, empty out baskets. I was absolutely appalled, you know, here I was, new to Washington. And my predecessor, not only had he not in any way briefed me, but just left me there with nothing. So I, you know, went into the editorial room of the Washington Post and told the editor, you know, this was all very embarrassing, but I needed help, because it turned out that he'd even given instructions that all the mail coming into the Guardian was to be forwarded to him. So anyway, we had to put a stop to that immediately. And, you know, they were very kind. But then I phoned Alistair Cook in New York and told him what had happened. And Alistair, you know, at long last, you know, his moment of revenge had come, immediately came and took a flight to New York, to Washington, and said he would organize a big party for me and introduce me to everybody in Washington, which indeed he did. And, you know, so we had a large party in the Mayflower Hotel, and that's where I met Pierre Salinger and you know, all the other correspondents and a lot of the sort of the people who run Washington. And, you know, I never looked back from that, but that was rather amusing, the way Alistair finally had an opportunity to come to Washington and show his mettle and what he could do, and that he could still get anybody who mattered. I don't know whether he tried to get the president. I don't think he did, but, and I don't know if Kennedy would have come, but certainly all the others came. And, you know, that was the beginning of my little reign in Washington that time. And then I went back to New York, and then in 67, the Guardian had a great, dramatic financial crisis, and they decided that they had to close down the UN Bureau and reduce their staff in America. And I was sent off to Geneva to do that. They gave me a wonderful title. I was called the European Integration Correspondent or something like that. This was, of course, at the time when Britain was again trying to beginning to think of getting back getting into the common market, having been turned down by de Gaulle the first time round. And I was sent to Geneva partly because of my UN connections and my UN experience, and also because arms control and disarmament was going to sort of remain part of my bailiwick, and that was the sort of European end, seemed to be the European end of disarmament negotiations in the UN context. And so that's where I went from New York. And that's when I really first started getting more directly involved in East Westray, because I was there in 68. During the Prague Spring, a lot of the British papers had sent correspondents from London to be in Prague for a few weeks at a time, and then they would replace them. And I was about to go to Prague to replace one of the Guardian's correspondents who had been there for a while. And literally on the day before I was due to fly to Prague, at about midnight, I had a phone call from a colleague on the Daily Express saying, have you heard the news about the invasion of Czechoslovakia, the tanks coming, and the tanks marching into Prague? And of course, I knew nothing. I'd been packing or whatever. Excuse me. And I picked up the phone to the Guardian, and the Guardian knew nothing as yet, because apparently the only wire service which had had the news so far had been AFP, the French news agency, and the Guardian didn't subscribe to the French news agency.